I'm glad you're all here, and I'm anxious to get underway because I want us to have time for the kind of discussions that happen at Holden Village. I am, in fact, going to quit talking no matter where I am in the presentation at, let's say, no later than 20 past, because we will have plenty to talk about by then. My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the first of five sessions on morality in the United States today. I have a complicated thesis that includes the following. We are living now from moral fragments and community fragments only in this society, and they are being destroyed faster than they are being replenished. There are causes of this which can be traced. Some of those causes are short-term, the character of the 1980s, for example. Some of them are long-term. Tonight we're going to talk about some of those. The nature of modernity that's several centuries deep. These causes make inordinately difficult the work of those particular communities which have moral formation as a part of their work, which have the formation of human character and conscience as an important part of their vocation. This living from moral fragments and community fragments only for a complicated set of reasons makes it very difficult for these particular communities, such as families, schools, neighborhoods, churches, other voluntary organizations, makes it difficult for them to shape human character and conscience. Now, having analyzed, or we will in the course of the week analyze some of these long-term causes, then I want us to turn to look at the ecology of moral community. What are the requirements for viable moral community? And then finally to give special attention to the roles that the churches can and should play in all of this. Okay, all of that was meant as a teaser to get you to buy a brand new book. The book is entitled Moral Fragments and Moral Community, a proposal for church and society, and it came out a couple of weeks ago and is in the bookstore. So I won't plug the book often, but I'll plug it less often if you buy it. We will take five topics from the book. We will not be doing the book as such for two reasons. One is that there's far too little time to take up everything that I have tried to take up in the book. But the second reason is that we'll discuss together, as I said, about half of each session, and the book doesn't have the foggiest notion of what's on your minds and where those conversations will go. That's just unpredictable. And so we will move from the book into conversations. All right, now tonight's topic, I'm just calling Moral Fragments and the American Dream. The thesis is that the American Dream is actually far more profound than the usual picture of it, which is typically a house, a car, a happy 2.2 family, that's the number of children, and a rising standard of living and or upwardly mobile, career-focused folks. I'm saying that the American Dream is far more than rank materialism and unbridled individualism, which is often a characterization of it, as well as the contention that it is an opportunity for individual fulfillment in the context of liberty. But my thesis also is that the American dream is now far more profoundly fragmented and jeopardized than any short-term response can rectify, including a change of administration. That's nothing against this change of administration. I was vigorously in favor of it. But if it is a profound American dream with some several centuries of rootage, then if it is in fact deeply fragmented and jeopardized, then it's not probably subject to being put together again in simple and short-term fashion. I think a lot of folks today sense this, but have some difficulty naming what it is they're uneasy about in a satisfying way. And I hope that some of our discussions this week can be about some collective naming of what it is that gives us some unease these days about morality in this society and about the state of affairs with the American dream. All right. Now, I said I would cease and desist here in 20 minutes. In 20 minutes, I want to sketch the movement and the vision that generated the American dream and say what I think has happened to it. If after I try to do that, you have no reaction whatsoever to that, then I either have failed miserably in the arts of teaching, or else you should check your pulse to see if you're among the quick rather than the dead. On the board here, I have placed some of the streams of modernity. You may or may not be able to read this because of the lighting, so let me just mention some of the elements that have go into what we're going to collectively term modernity. The new economy was new at that time, namely capitalism. Science and technology from the 17th century onward. Democracy is the polity of choice, also arising at roughly the same time, at least in the modern form. It has some deeper roots than that. The nation state, which gets going for the Peace of Westphalia of 1648 and becomes the primary unit of political jurisdiction. An Enlightenment ethic, we'll talk a little bit about that. And the bourgeoisie, what we would call the rising middle class, bourgeoisie class and culture. All right. Pardon?
What is your time period?
Well, one time period is 20 minutes. The other time period is about the 17th century forward. Yeah, modernity in the literature is usually inclusive of the last 500 years, but we can't do 500 years in 20 minutes, so we're going to have to move it up a bit. There's a lot of discussion, again, I say lots. This represents the parochialism of academia, I'm sure. But within that particular province, there's a lot of talk about modernity and the postmodern. And we, I think, live at this very uneasy place between sensing the end of some kind of age, but not being at all clear about that which is struggling to be born or maybe just falling apart. We don't know. I mean, when people start using post words like post-Cold War or post-Christendom or post-modernity, you can be sure they do not know where they are going. Those are all words to say where you've come from, but where you're headed, you're not sure. And so there's a lot of talk now about us living in a postmodern world. Well, let's talk first about what modernity is and then see why people start using post in reference to it. Modernity, in the briefest kind of explication of it, is the name for the promise of rational, science-based progress as a human historical project that is linked to capitalist and socialist economies. Rational, science-based progress linked to capitalist and socialist economies, with a claim on democracy as the polity of choice, with, as I said, the nation state as a primary form of political sovereignty, and with the bourgeoisie, the rising middle class, as modernity's kind of almost inventor, and certainly its avant-garde. Now that's, in one complicated sentence, what is encompassed by modernity. It's got global reach now, as anyone who looks through this list, capitalism, nation state, democracy, can see. But it was Western, is Western in its origins, and it was a reaction against those interminable religious wars that followed the Reformation, and a reaction against the superstition and the ignorance and the misery that marked the Middle Ages. There was a genuine epochal break with the Enlightenment of the 17th century, and then the bourgeois revolutions of the 18th century, and the Industrial Revolution, and scientific breakthroughs of the 18th and 19th centuries. This cluster was a genuine new age, and it was there that the modern vision came into focus. Now, it was a human-centered liberation vision. The Enlightenment was the first liberation movement of our times. And what it promised through science, technology, and a dynamic new economy was to bring the forces of nature and culture under control and to subject them to human design. We could have a world of our own making, and it could be good. Now, that may not sound like something new to you, because you're living with that assumption. But up until this time, life was largely fated. And modernity says it is not fated. It is subject to human possibilities, and the powers for human transformation of it are finally, after fitful millennia, in human hands. All right. More than that, however, through scientific knowledge and technology and the extension of industrial civilization and democratic processes, poverty, disease, and toil could all be made matters of the past. They could be replaced with increased abundance and untrammeled opportunities in a world that had now no sense for limit. There was also another matter which we'll just mention in passing, even though at this in this setting we should talk more about it, but that's up to you later. There was also a secularizing of society that is a part of modernity. It's a very exceptional chapter in human history that religion plays the part of being a voluntary matter for those who wish it, rather than the integrator of society and the undergirding of a culture. But with the Enlightenment, we had the secularizing of society, which is also a reaction to those nasty religious wars and the heavy-handedness of the church. It was then made a matter of personal choice and practice, voluntary choice and practice. Now, there's a lot of history here that gets more complicated than that. But we had something rather curious now. We had capitalism in fact, offering us a certain freedom from economics. Economics as the age-old struggle against scarcity. We didn't really have to worry that much anymore about that, over that daily obsession with where we would get the wherewithal to put our material existence together. Capitalism was a kind of freedom from economics, almost. Democracy would release us from politics as the worry that comes with power in the hands of people not accountable to you. We didn't have to worry so much about politics. It didn't bear down on us. Science-based progress would contribute the most of all. Since science provided the constant revisioning of things in keeping with testing and self-corrected procedures, it would save us from the terror of the unknown, and it would open up new possibilities for us. We don't have this sense that pre-modern people did of discontinuity. Discontinuity and change were pictured in much the same way that the biblical writers pictured chaos. But we have a sense that science and technology gives us a kind of possibility of making the changes that we want to make, or adjusting as we need to adjust. Well, you're doing fine. With
you're
such.
Doing fine too,
all right, thank you very much. I want to hear an amen sometime or another for you. All right.
We thought you were ready for election.
Well, with such a vision and a promise as this, it's small wonder that the most youthful nation, the one that was born with the advent of modernity, put on each and every dollar bill, novum seclo, novum ordo seclorum, new world order. Check your billfold. It's there. The United States was the first nation born in modernity. It's no wonder that apostles of the New Age, like Francis Bacon, wrote volumes entitled Novum Organum and the New Atlantis. This is an epochal break, and it was felt to be that. They claimed, as Bacon did, just a little aside, that the power of the citizens of a country to subject fellow citizens and the power of some countries to subject other countries was crass and vulgar compared with the supreme human vocation itself, quote Bacon now, to establish and extend the power and dominion of human race itself over the universe. Now there, that's a task. Evidently, as Langdon Winner wryly comments, we must subject something. And nature and the universe, unlike peoples and countries, won't mind. You know where we are on that one these days. But modernity, you see, has as its master image the image of mastery itself. Modernity is a philosophy that believes in progress and control, and the two of them together. And it puts human beings over against their world. Even over not just nature, but also society. Well, that's what Marxism is about. You can make the transformation of society the object of human design. Now we add also the psyche. That's what Freud was about. What do you do to get yourself in shape? You take your psyche to a workshop. You monitor and master anxiety. You build relationships. Nature, society, and psyche are all made subject to an image of mastery in which we are the masters. All right. even the most articulate, penetrating, and organized criticisms of industrial capitalism, namely the socialist ones, never abandoned the immaculate confidence in science and technology, and never abandoned the primary assumption of the bourgeoisie that we could have a world of our own making and it could be good. That is, the socialist countries were every bit as much a part of modernity as the capitalist ones. All right. Things sometimes do go awry. And now we're facing a lot of rather severe doubts about modernity. I only want to interject that I hope, even in this brief time, I have shown that there is something more to the American dream than rank materialism or a notion of untrammeled opportunity within the context of freedom. All of these streams belong to it. A kind of confidence in science and technology, a nationalism, democracy, capitalism as the preferred. We even get contentions these days that the triumph of democratic capitalism is in fact the end of history. I mean, that's the kind of claims that are being made. It's the end of history in the sense that there doesn't need to be something beyond this. It isn't the end of history in the sense that it comes to a close. All right. Okay, I've got 5 minutes. I want to tell you why we have some doubts about this and then ask your participation in a discussion. The great promise of modernity, then, is autonomy and deliverance in the form of, blessed form, of ever-increasing well-being for all. That's foundered. Some places it's crashed. It still has millions of what I think are rather desperate believers. And for lack of any institutional alternatives, it continues some of its deadly habits. But it bleeds now like the Exxon Valdez and begins to look a little bit like some beached whale, sort of huge and impressive, but in some kind of trouble. Or if not that, that's not quite right. More like a wounded giant that's floundering about on a series of realities that we are now beginning to recognize relate to one another. And this is what we have not seen. Some other folks have seen it, but most of us in this room haven't seen it for a reason I'm going to give. Here's the series of realities that now looks like it belongs together as expression of modernity. Economies, whether capitalist or socialist, that are so totally out of sync with nature's requirements for its own regeneration as to slowly threaten something like ecocide. Economies that don't even ask what nature requires to sustain them. And since every economy is only and always a subset of the ecosystems, that's a serious problem. The destruction of indigenous cultures and peoples, which has happened everywhere modernity has reached. Does that have something to do with those kinds of economies? Yes, it does.
We just said that again, Larry.
The destruction of indigenous cultures and peoples. Remember, the master image here is an image of mastery itself and limitlessness, a world in the making by our making. The breakdown of close community and organic traditions. This was recognized by the sociologists of the first generation, Weber, Durkheim, Georg Simmel, others, from the outset, that modernity undermined traditional communities, pre-modern communities. And I want to say more about how that happens and why that happens later in the week. Just mention it here. Another reality that we're facing, the disintegrative effects for society, psyche, and nature of living out this image of mastery and control as the primary image for humanity. Further, the development of weapons of apocalyptic destruction. The mountain of debt incurred by maintaining civilization and paying for its debris costs far exceeding what it took to put that in place in the first instance. We can't afford modernity. The immiseration of the growing urban poor and the evacuation of many rural areas in something like an Appalachia manner. The recognition that while different, the forms of oppression of women, many minorities, third world, and indigenous peoples are linked, and they arise from forces that oppress land and nature as well. There's a common pattern there that we are seeing. And then finally, the onset amidst abundance itself of frazzled nerves, addiction, rootlessness, stress, chronic fatigue, and depression as serious diseases of a scattered soul and a restless and rather impoverished spirit. Now, I mean, this is like arriving at the, a little like King Pyrrhus after the Battle of Asculum, you know. Another such victory, and we are undone. If you want modernity to keep on winning here, but it's not the end of modernity. It's far from over. I think, though, that we are sensing that there is something deeply problematic about that which we have taken for granted for a long while now. Now it's true. Whoops! Just I got to finish now. As the beneficiaries of modernity, most of us middle Americans have not yet experienced the full ambulance load of pain that it can and has delivered to some peoples. We do not yet quite feel like the psalmist, even, who lamented that God had fed the people with the bread of tears and had given them bowls of tears to drink. We don't feel that way. We're a little bit like, a little more like, those largest dinosaurs whose brains were so far from their tails that when they experienced injuries in their hindmost parts, it took so long for the signals to get to their brains that they went on grazing unfazed for a while. But the injury does register, and we are now beginning to talk about the fragmentation, about these elements, nature, psyche, and society being jeopardized in ways that we didn't quite understand. And we also wonder what in the world an alternative would be like. So, enough. Yeah, Chuck.
You didn't mention the rise of humanism and the ultimate perfectionability of mankind. Is one of the
yeah, good addition. Certainly of continuing improvement, whether you had some sense of ultimate perfectibility or not. Some sense of continuing improvement. Yeah. Yeah, well, Deanne.
On that point, Larry, I'd be interested to hear your assessment of how the recovery movements fit in. Is this a, I won't offer options. I'm making a multiple choice question. Where does it fit?
Recovery movements.
Yeah.
We need a 12-step program for modernity. Well, I don't know. As I mentioned in the other session, a good question is usually an answer in disguise, and you've got some thoughts about that, and I'd like to hear them.
I'm not sure if I do. I mean, I find that whole, I guess one of the things that I always wondering about that movement is whether or not it has the expectation of perfectibility.
Mm-hmm.
When I listen to people use the language of 12-step movements or other kinds of therapeutic communities, it often sounds to me as if they think, if I can just get this right, everything is going to be better than okay.
Yeah.
And so if indeed, you know, is that an effort to recapture the promise of modernity? Is it an expression of modernity?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what the connection might
yeah.
be there.
Well, let's speculate that about that, and I'm sure other people will join. I mean, I immediately have a kind of two or three responses. One just follows upon yours. I think that in many ways, like some New Age religious movements, it represents modernity. That is, it is it's undertaken under the conviction that we can, if we go about this in the right way, reach the goals that we want for ourselves. But I think that's probably not enough said. I think it's also a reaction to the, what I, for lack of better terms, I'll call the diseases of modernity, and simply an effort to cope with them. I mean, addiction's a serious issue.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And one has to address it. And and so it's undertaken as a genuine response to come to terms with some of the spin-offs of the kind of way of life that modernity represents for us. So it may not even share the fond dreams and hopes. It's simply a matter of coping to do with it. If I have a complaint, it is that so very often it is, I mean, in the simplest terms, a treatment of symptoms and not causes. And very, very many of the efforts at, whether it's 12-step or self-help groups, I mean, the biggest rack of literature is the self-help literature, and some of it is certainly ought to be used and commended, but if it doesn't ever see the connections between what it is that's giving rise to these problems and their causes, then it's only treating the symptoms. And it might work for this or that person, but you will continue to have a society which makes for stress, which makes for addiction, which makes for depression. It's a little bit like talking about family problems and not understanding what the economy has done to families. We try to treat the problems as a interpersonal problem within the family without realizing what does it mean that the pre-modern, more organic, more settled communities in which families had their place and in which not both parents were involved in careers and meant to make ends meet or choice, whatever. I mean, it's a little bit like that.
Right. And in fact, in pre-modern, neither parent was.
Yeah, or the whole family was involved. Yeah. I want to make one thing clear. I'm not in favor of returning to pre-modern communities. I think there were two morally homogeneous and oppressive and excluded an awful lot of people that, because of the good side of modernity, now have a voice. So we could spend a whole session on what is positive about this. What I'm mostly concerned about is that we see something about where the American dream is now, vis-a-vis this. And you're welcome to say, you know, not stress as I have, the linkages of things that are problematic. There are very positive things to say. And that's also part of the unease, because we fear that some of those real gifts might be lost, such as heightened freedoms. Yeah.
But your diagnosis still sounds like a new idolatry.
Why?
The idol of mastery.
Yeah.
I mean, that somehow we actually have it in our power.
Yeah.
In wisdom to control.
Yeah.
Even
though it's not the least bit biblical, we really have had an assumption that what we create is under our control. I don't see a lot of evidence for that. The world's too complicated for that. But that is a kind of idolatry. Yeah. Okay, are we finished? All going to church now? Are we singing? Oh, well, we got 10 minutes. We can talk a while here before Beanie sings.
Talk around.
Yeah, the sense of security is certainly different. I mean, one thing that I find so refreshing about Holden, I'm a New Yorker, you understand, Upper West Side of Manhattan, and is to come and have the doors open. I mean, I would just never dream of that at home. And when I think back on my childhood, and again, I'm not being nostalgic about all of my childhood, but this loss of sense of freedom in the sense of security, to come and go as one please and not be worried about taking precautions, to live a kind of unguarded life. When I think back on my childhood, my dad had a little service station in a little bit of a burg, 50 people. And when he would come home for lunch, if one of us kids didn't go over and take over, he would just leave a little pad on the counter, and people would come in and they would fill their car up with gas or their tractor or their truck, and then they'd just write the amount down on the pad there and settle up later. When we went on vacation, which was a family affair, extended family affair, usually for a week on a lake somewhere, my dad did not lock the garage, what was called the garage, because folks needed to get their gas. And we didn't lock the house either, because we didn't think about that. I don't know. I guess we had keys, but I bet we couldn't have found them.
So, in this room. That's been lost in this generation.
Well, yeah, I could share with you the statistics on the escalation of crime. You don't need to know them. You do need to know that this, I'm being defensive now, you do need to know that this isn't simply the city moving in on your turf if you're in the suburbs. I mean, the language is often the city invading the suburbs, it's an invasion, or it's some virus that goes out there. But the disintegration, the fragmentation, the increase in crime is happening everywhere, in the suburbs and in rural areas. Something is going on other than the contagion of city life. And the book, did I say I was going to not give a commercial for the book? The the book says that the reason we're in trouble is because these communities that have done moral formation, the processes of socialization from one generation to the next, are largely no longer intact, from families to neighborhoods to communities, etc. Now, you may not have liked a lot of the socialization that they did. And again, I'm not nostalgic about that. But when you don't have them doing much of anything, then you have a kind of amoral society. And if you've got stress of all kinds, then you get the kind of situation you're talking about, Roxy. I think there's a lot of kind of free-floating anger that doesn't know, and more precisely, alienation. People don't know where they fit and aren't certain about the future, that they'll have a place there. So there's a kind of free-floating alienation and free-floating anxiety. And when the stressful situation when those stressful situations come, then very often one reacts with what is closest at hand, and that might be a weapon, even if it's one's fist. Private army, no less. I think that's accurate. My only comment is that modernity and the American dream had given an expectation of a way of life far better than medieval life. I mean, so it isn't that one wants to make comparisons, but if you do make comparisons, we didn't expect to have to face the kind of sense of insecurity and the need for protection that has been the case in many other societies. Yeah. I would like to hear, we are going to bring this to a close soon, and those of you who would like to go leave to further be anything, feel most free to do so. Those who would like to stay and discuss for another 5 minutes or so are also welcome to do that. Well, I would like just to hear what people's feelings, reflections are about the future of the American dream, because I may just be reflecting, you know, the East Coast. And the East Coast does not participate, by and large, in the kind of optimism that the West Coast does. And no, I mean, this is true.
We have optimism?
Well, I'm asking. But I mean, basically, we're a more sort of, yeah, and the kind of solid character of the Midwest, the kind of sureness that is there. And so this presentation may just reflect my own experience rather than it being generalized. So that's why I would like to hear other feelings. Yeah, Shirley.
Isn't a fundamental part of this the fact that more and more people within and without our borders are expecting participate in this American dream,
yeah,
are not finding it all that easy to do so.
Yeah,
it's fundamental to the whole issue.
Yeah, thanks for that. A year ago, I was at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, and Boutros Ghali, the Secretary General of the United Nations, gave an address there and said things I never expected to hear from a politician and a diplomat. He said, "The time of the finite world has come." Then he went on to talk about an epistemological break. I've never heard a politician talk about epistemological breaks. The time of the finite world has come. I mean, his point was that there simply isn't unlimited opportunity but that we are facing all manner of problems which tends to make for more refugees, more immigrants, more movements across borders as you come up against limits in this setting and in that setting. So you two are from Southern California. You can tell us a lot about the sense in California. The sheen has gone off the Golden State here.
Quality of life we can provide for all the people who wish to come here.
But the expectation that something is better there than at home still remains, and the lure for immigrants remains.
And the stress is caused by the people who are already there asking themselves if their own lifestyle is reasonably to be diminished because of the demands of other people's, and that may be a viable truth, that we may have to be an equalizer.
But if we are an equalizer, and if we're talking about any kind of redistribution, then we've come up against a flat-out contradiction of the American dream. Because the American dream has said, again, with John Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats, or, in terms of the economy, you bake a bigger pie rather than differently distribute the fixed pie that you have.
Well, the national debt would indicate we can't keep making a bigger pie.
No. Yeah, and how difficult it is for us to face that. Because when we're told that we're going to have to pay more and get far less, that doesn't compute at all.
Look at it. You got that right.
No, but that's part of what I was trying to say earlier, that it costs more to maintain what we have and pay for the damage than it costs to put that in place in the first instance.
Especially environmental.
Yeah, that's where we're going to have more and more costs. That's what I mean about having to pay more and getting less. Both Adam Smith and Karl Marx. All right. Well, I'm going to close now, and I haven't made any connections either to the theme, Listen to the Sacred, or to the Christian motifs, but I'll just close with this. I personally, even though I'm not happy about this kind of analysis, remind myself that Christian faith was born and took fire in an age that felt itself to be a time between times. It talks that language of a passing age, an age of mourning. It's a time of deep insecurity. It was very eclectic. It was multicultural, multiracial, multireligious. The Hellenistic period was this kind of unsettledness. And Christian faith has some resources for living precisely in such a time, because it was in such a time that its formative lines were set down. It may be hard for us to get back to them because of an acculturation of that faith, but it's tuned to just such times. Now, we'll call it modernity, postmodernity, but it's tuned to times between times and deep change.